Okay, this is continuing with Taffy Bowen on June 22nd, 1978, part two. Part one was about 5 years ago. And I've just got some odd questions based on looking at the transcript of part one. Let's just go through these in order. I was wondering if you'd comment more specifically about how you see the relationship between the development of radar during World War II and before, and the early radio astronomy, the first 5 or 10 years of it. Is it fair to say that the one is a direct outgrowth of the other, or just how do you see that relationship?
Well, I think it'd be fair to say that it is a direct outcome. There was the British president, of course, which we know about and which I won't go into, with Lovell and Ryle and Hay involved, straight out of wartime radar. And in almost exactly the same way in Australia,
right.
The work at the Radio Physics Lab, which was predominantly a radar laboratory, which, as I might have described before, was very lucky at the end of the war in having a clean break from military responsibilities.
Yes, right, you did
and
mention that.
Going into civil research activities. So there was a very specific step taken. Let's take a look at all the possibilities for research in this field, including, I might say, ionospheric, which was responsible for radio research for. And we did several reviews. I can't think of the total number of projects we had in mind, but it was a lot, like 10 or 12.
Mm-hmm.
Which we might have followed up. All of these were very carefully considered and worked through. In many cases, a start was made. We actually tried a few of these things.
What were a couple examples of things that did not pan out?
Well, other than radio astronomy, I would say navigation, of course, which did pan out,
right.
With civil aviation activities. And, of course, it's come back again in
right.
in the Interscan in the late 1970s. Resonant cavities, in fact, we made the first million volt single cavity accelerator.
Is this what Mills worked on?
Mills, that's right.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And the original paper on that is in Nature. In fact, I was involved, my own name was on it, I was involved myself. That was successful as far as it went, but we frankly missed the multiplication process. We didn't see how to multiply by 10. Otherwise, we could easily have been in the linear accelerator business.
I see.
But
why didn't you follow that one up, for instance?
Two reasons. One is that nuclear activity, nuclear research, of course, was becoming the province of the Atomic Energy Commission. So we tended to pull away from anything nuclear, although this was particle acceleration, which is slightly different. And secondly, we thought very hard about how to multiply up,
mm-hmm.
and we missed it. In fact, I can recollect the miss, but we couldn't see how to focus the beam.
Yeah.
And of course,
yeah.
It was boys like Louis Alvarez who...
Alvarez at Berkeley?
Yeah, at Berkeley, who thought of the scheme for keeping the beam in focus, and once you take that step, of course, the linear accelerator follows. So, there are a few examples of the kind of thing mm-hmm. we tried, but the criterion now for going on with it, of course, was success.
Mm-hmm.
And the things that Porsche was trying on the sun and Burton mm-hmm. on point sources were so outstandingly successful that that's the way we went.
Now, the original list of choices and then the decisions to keep them, was that a group of people that made the decision, or was that pretty much yourself?
Relatively small numbers of people, myself particularly.
Mm-hmm.
But with Pawsey and a few others, I'd say it would be a very small group of people who were directly involved.
And so the only criterion was success, and you didn't really care whether it led you down one road or another road.
No, it wasn't. And we had the freedom, I must say. We had the large number of first-rate staff as a handout from the war and encouragement to find new projects at that time.
Well, let's follow this general question up into later years. What was the decision-making role, particularly of you versus Pawsey, as time went on, in deciding whether something should, you know, get funding and manpower support? Did it vary, or was there some definite pattern?
I would say that roughly the same criterion would apply. That is, either success or the possibility of success. I'll give an example. Any of the early interferometer, multiple antenna interferometer things, were clearly a goer. And since they involved relatively small financial obligations, very often the equipment which is on hand are very easily made.
You're talking about, for instance, when Mills was had his microwave link and... radio link.
Some of the preliminaries that led up to the very first cross, the small cross,
right,
at Potts Hill, I'm referring
the
to.
Model,
yeah, the model. Yeah, things like that. So, let's say that the expenditures and the manpower involved was comparatively small, well within the capacity of the lab, so no big decisions had to be taken. If it worked, and even Mills was not confident that the first cross correlation would, that was the trial to see that it would work. So that there was no great commitment for a start. Once it looked like working, well, we were on it.
Right. So in general, you and Pawsey would be in agreement on this,
right,
it would be pretty clear.
The same went for the spectrographic work, by exactly the same process. And there, of course, we had, again, a background of radio intercept work, scanning.
That's right. You mentioned that before, yeah, about your suggestion.
Fall back on, in days, almost a week, you know, the things away and flying. So the decisions were so easy to make under those conditions. Another example which you might have come across, which didn't work out, of course, is that there's a suggestion more than once that, countering the Ryle situation, that it was the radio physics boys who first thought of aperture synthesis. And there are some sentences in an early paper of Ruby Payne Scott and Pawsey and McCready.
Yes,
which can be interpreted that way.
The principle that the brightest distribution is the Fourier transform,
right,
of the visibility.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's right in there.
It's there, all right, but it was never a concept.
Yeah.
Nobody came and pounded on my desk and said, look, we've
right,
you know. So although the thought was there, I'm just trying to draw the distinction from between things that we did follow up and things that we didn't.
Yeah.
There was literally no decision on that. It never came up in any forcible way.
One just occurred to me that I found from the files and also from talking with John Bolton is that he wanted to have a large dish at one point
on
a cliff.
Mm-hmm.
And that one was not funded.
Mm.
Now, what was the reason for that, basically, the reason?
Money. Let's say that at that time there were a multitude of such proposals going around, holes in the ground, and God knows what were being suggested. And up to a certain point in time, which I'd find hard to define, I mean, the final time, whenever money was involved, it was out the window. So that one can think of pre-1954 or thereabouts.
I see.
When, if someone wanted to spend $100,000, it was not. Just,
I see.
Yeah, no way. Which goes back, of course, to funding, as far as CSIRO was concerned. And this was CSIRO-Y. But the whole organization was very well set up for salaries and operating. I mean, I told you this before.
Yes, you
salary
did.
And operating, but capital, even, well, new buildings, anything you like, or a big piece of equipment, just was very, very difficult to get across. politically, I mean, it would have to go, not the cabinet, but well up into the parliamentary process.
No hope. Well, you mentioned this before, and in fact, I wanted to ask you this time, why was this situation that way? Is it just some peculiarity of Australian governmental organization?
I think it was a peculiarity that